Rain and snow are coming. The campfire, meanwhile, has displaced thousands of people who are going to have a rough Thanksgiving. Last weekend, President Trump said $500 million in federal aid would be put in the farm bill. A SACB headline now calls that an error. On Insight, the Sacramento Bee's Washington correspondent Emily Cadet talks with me about that $500 million comment and the broader issue of federal aid for people in the wildfire disaster area. Pet expert Gina Spadafori is here to share stories of animal rescues from the campfire. I'll check in then with a few of the Tahoe ski areas. Some are already open. Everybody's excited about the snowy forecast. And then 25 years of the Thanksgiving Day tradition, the Run to Feed the Hungry. Rain or shine, tomorrow in Sacramento. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Every day, the numbers at the campfire change. Containment today is listed at 80%. 81 people are confirmed dead, 870 today are listed as missing, and more than 13,500 homes have been destroyed. So Thanksgiving is going to be a difficult time for everyone affected in any way by this wildfire. When President Trump visited the burned town of Paradise this past weekend, he talked about additional federal aid. His quote was, "So we're putting in the farm bill $500 million. You might remember Ben Adler talking with me Monday about what that comment might mean. But then yesterday, the Sacramento Bee's Washington correspondent, Emily Cadet, posted a follow-up story about it. She's been reporting and researching the comment. She's joining us now by phone from Washington. Hi, Emily. Glad you had time for Insight today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about what you found out about that $500 million.
Well, apparently President was confused because there isn't actually any additional money coming for forest management or fire prevention in the farm bill. Technically, the farm bill is, in Washington, wonk speak, what we call an authorization bill. So it doesn't actually provide money for anything. It just authorizes programs. So we confirmed that there wasn't, in fact, any money being inserted into the farm bill for fires. Any funding that would come for forest management, as Trump was talking about, would have to come in a separate spending bill. But there as well, it sounds like the administration is not requesting additional funds beyond what has already been drafted for fire management for the coming year.
So the U.S. Forest Service is under the USDA, and that could be part of the farm bill. So that part is correct, right?
Right. There is a forestry provision in the farm bill. So the farm bill really sets out the parameters of programs, and it certainly sets policies for how programs can be carried forward, but it doesn't set particular sums of money for those programs. So in the farm bill, which is still being negotiated in Congress, there are a number of provisions related to forest management. Those simply don't have dollar figures attached to them, however.
There was a chance to clarify this in this press conference that has been reported in the news today that included Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue. So tell me how he answered questions about it and anybody else you spoke to about this, Emily.
Well, what Secretary Perdue and Secretary Zinke, the Department of Interior Secretary, both emphasized on the call was they want new authorizations in the Farm Bill. They want, basically what they're asking for is for Congress to allow them to avoid certain environmental review processes for forest management projects, particularly logging projects, forest thinning projects. And when I asked Secretary Perdue if he was also asking for more money from Congress for forest management, he said no, they are not asking for additional funds. There's already a certain pocket of money that's in the bill that has not been passed by Congress that they also need to pass before the end of the year, the spending bill for forest management, but they're not asking for more money on top of that.
The president has continued to hit hard on forest management. There was a letter put out by the White House press office, and in it, it is urging congressional action on this. And I think you also saw this letter, Emily, where the conversation is that The legislation, the farm bill, should ultimately include these provisions. It kind of lays out the what-if scenario. But is it any more than that at this point? Just a what-if, or we wish this would happen?
Well, they're basically trying to pressure the negotiators in Congress right now. There's a House version of the Farm Bill, which includes these measures that the White House and the secretaries want, and then there's a Senate bill that does not. And they're trying to reconcile differences right now. And what they're talking about is pretty controversial. It's very strongly opposed by environmental groups. They say that it would be dangerous to roll back those environmental review requirements. And it would be very difficult to get those provisions in the final farm bill just because of the opposition in the Senate. And so the Republicans are really trying to put pressure now on negotiators to include some of that. I think it's still unlikely, just given the balance of power in Congress. But that's sort of the debate that's playing out. But it's entirely separate from this 500 million number that Trump was talking about, which nobody in Congress seems to know what he was referring to. And certainly they say it's not actually a number that's being added in the farm bill.
Did you find even one person who knew about that number or where it might have come from?
No. And the White House would not address the question. I worked with one of our White House correspondents to try and get the White House to answer what he was referring to, and they would not address the specifics of that. My best guess is that he's just confusing the figure that's already in the spending that has yet to be passed, that's roughly $500 million for forest management. That's a number that would be consistent with past years. That's nothing new. That's not an increase. In previous years, Congress has appropriated somewhere between $500 and $600 million for forest management programs. So I can't say exactly what the president was thinking, but he clearly got some numbers mixed up in his head and some pieces of legislation mixed up as well.
I'm talking with the Sacramento Bee's Washington correspondent, Emily Cadet. You brought up the House and Senate, so let me also note that a letter was sent out from both California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. And in this, it looks like they're just asking for wildfire victims to be included in disaster funding. And so I explored this a little further, and what we're talking about here is perhaps additional money beyond what FEMA already has for disaster funding. And it sounds like the senators just want to have a place in line. Do you think I'm characterizing that correctly?
My understanding is more or less that that's right. Basically, as it stands now, the agencies that are responsible for the emergency response in California, so FEMA, the USDA, HUD for housing services, all of those agencies are working on the ground. And right now they have the funding in their current budgets that they believe will be necessary to help respond to the existing crises. So it doesn't sound like there's going to need to be additional funding. Sometimes, like last year with all the really catastrophic hurricanes, there was a supplemental sort of emergency funding bill to add money to those agencies. But it doesn't sound like that's necessary. And the big thing the senators are really pushing for right now is just to make sure that wildfire victims get special consideration from the IRS when it comes to tax relief, that they are eligible for certain deductions, that they're make sure they're eligible for certain programs. And that will probably come in any final legislation that Congress passes by the end of the year.
Senator Feinstein's office clarified for me that of the three supplemental bills last year passed for this FEMA funding that you're talking about, Emily, the third one did include wildfire relief. And so in 2017, $1.47 billion went to the Napa-Sonoma area, and $241 million went to the Southern California Ventura area. So as I understand it, what this is addressing is whatever those supplemental bills might be. But anyone listening to this conversation might wonder, is there going to be enough money to cover my loss? Is there enough money here for what we just experienced? And it was reinforced to me, too, that FEMA has disaster funding to cover what has happened this year in hurricanes and in wildfires so far. Is that your same understanding?
Yes, it is. And it's worth keeping in mind that actually it's a new fiscal year for government. So as of October 1, they started fiscal year 2019. So they're actually fairly new into this current fiscal year. So they still have quite a bit of money in their accounts at this point. And so when I've asked the agencies where things stand, it sounds like they're not going to run out of money. And again, this is for the immediate kind of relief and disaster response, rebuilding, et cetera. Although, as I think Governor Brown has noted and others have noted, this is going to be a long-term effort to rebuild. And the federal government has committed, by issuing the disaster declarations, it has committed to helping the state with those rebuilding efforts and with rebuilding money.
And that's important to note that none of this actually kicks into motion until the president declares a disaster area, which allows the disaster funding to be put into motion. So that's why that was really important at the beginning of the Camp Fire and the president's relationship with California leadership, that disaster declaration happen.
Right. And that's actually something that the White House has been very good about, responding very quickly with the disaster declarations. There has been good cooperation between the federal government and the state of California on that front. And I think Governor Brown has reflected that and actually thanked the government for working together on that.
So we have reported at Cap Radio that more than 13,000 people now have applied for FEMA funds for this relief aid, and that can certainly happen at the center in the disaster zone. It can also happen online, too, and it's happening from all over the country right now, Emily.
Right, and certainly, you know, FEMA, unfortunately, has been, you know, getting more and more involved in these relief efforts as we've seen the catastrophic nature of the wildfires become greater, as the catastrophic nature of hurricanes has become greater in recent years. You know, you can debate what is causing climate change. I don't think that the scientists out there are really debating it that much anymore at this point, but certainly the disasters are getting worse. And so our federal first responders are having to do more and more and increase the amount that's budgeted to respond to these kind of disasters.
Okay, we are posting a link along with all of our other fire coverage to how to apply for FEMA funds for disaster relief. Before I let you go, Emily, would you talk about Nancy Pelosi right now in this process of negotiating support to be able to return to her Speaker of the House role? And this is leading up to the ultimate vote, which will be January 3rd.
Mm-hmm. Right. So she seems to be doing what Nancy Pelosi does best, which is twisting some arms, negotiating, leveraging the various sources of power that she has to bring people on board. It's basically a math game for her. She needs to get 218 votes in January to be the next speaker. And assuming no Republicans vote for her, which I think is a pretty safe assumption, she would need a certain number. She can't lose more than a certain number of Democrats. And so right now she's just trying to shore up her support among Democrats. And that involves, you know, offering committee posts or new leadership slots or making other types of promises on policy goals. So, you know, I think as long as Nancy Pelosi doesn't have a really open challenger, which she does not, I find it hard to imagine that she won't be the next speaker in January.
All right, Emily, there was snow last week in Washington, D.C. What kind of a Thanksgiving is ahead of you tomorrow?
It's supposed to be very cold here, actually, like abnormally cold. So we're going to be bundling up, but it'll be nice and quiet, hopefully, for once in Washington.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Have a safe and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks so much.
That's Emily Cadet. She is the Sacramento Bee's Washington correspondent. We'll post a link to her article and some of the letters that I referenced. And there's more wildfire coverage and that link to applying for disaster relief funds at capradio.org. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Some of the animal rescue stories from the campfire have been amazing and heartwarming, if you've watched some of the videos, too. Pet expert Gina Spadafori is here with some of those stories, and we're going to talk about some of the groups that have been key to helping animals and people and the reunions. Hi, Gina.
Good morning.
So to what extent is there focus on animals in a big megafire, big wildfire disaster?
You know, we saw things change with Katrina all that far back, where before that, that was kind of the bright shining line. And before that, it was like, we'll take care of the people, the animals can fend for themselves. That was pretty much the official thing. Well, a couple things happened. One, the experts came to realize that people would not leave without their animals and putting human lives at risk. So preparing to have animals come with the people actually saved human lives. Beyond the fact that, of course, we do care about the animals as well, but it saved human lives to make sure that the animals were cared for. And since then, we have seen all of these groups put in ready response units to take care of animals, to take these big semis to sites and care for animals. We've seen the vet schools, LSUs during Katrina, just took over the entire veterinary school to care for animals evacuated. And we've seen the vet schools step up. The shelters are better coordinated now. When the fire started, the shelters throughout Northern California swept in and took the pets that were waiting for adoption, so the shelters closest to the fires could have room for the animals that needed them, who are going to be looking for their owners. So it has changed just in my career. It has changed 180 degrees. And part of it is because we have so much more of a closer relationship with animals than we did. But part of it is a realization that saving animals saves people. And also, I mean, you can replace things, but when people come on the other side of a disaster, having their animals is so important to them. It just starts to heal because you have all your entire family together, two-legged and four-legged when you can.
Because you said that, I should say you do have a puppy with you today.
I do have a puppy.
Beautiful.
You can kind of hear him, you know, running around a little bit. He's being very good. His name is Bowie. And as you know, I often raise puppies for friends. That way I have a constant supply of puppies, but I never have to have like 100 dogs.
Right.
So Bowie will be with me until January, and I think we've already got him up on Twitter. He's a real sweet little guy.
What's happening in the campfire zone in terms of animal rescue and reunion?
You know, there's a group called the North Valley Animal Disaster Group, which has probably stepped up to be the top accountant for where the animals are, who's missing what, and what animals are where. Because, of course, these animals are spread all over. They're at the San Francisco SPCA. They're at the veterinary school at UC Davis. They're in shelters. They're in people's homes because people picked up, you know, dogs and cats and even horses and donkeys and pigs and goats. I mean, people have just done everything they can to help these people by getting their animals out of trouble and holding on to them. So the North Valley Animal Disaster Group has got tons of volunteers that are trying to see where these animals are so people can take a one-stop source to try to find them. Because it's really hard when you're coming through a disaster to say, I've got to go to this shelter, look at this shelter, look at this shelter. And let me just add, this is a perfect time to say, please microchip your pets, because your pet may not have had a collar, may have lost a collar. When animals are injured, especially in a fire, they don't look like themselves. Their fur may have been singed off. We're seeing a lot of that, of dogs that look nothing like they look like because they've lost fur, their eyes are damaged. But if you have a microchip, you can be reunited more quickly. So I really can't stress that enough. There's nothing more important in these situations in preparing for them than making sure that your pets are microchipped. And you know, birds and horses, all of these animals can be microchipped, not just dogs and cats.
You're reminding me of that video, I think, from UC Davis of the cat that had its paws all wrapped up, but it was in a box and reunited.
I saw that
with
one.
Its owner.
I saw that one.
I think there's kind of a two-way effort happening here, pets to people, people to pets. In some cases, people won't find their pets. In some cases, pets won't find their owners.
That's correct. And that is the scope of this tragedy is, I don't know, you can't even, it's beyond comprehension. And when you're looking at those many people who are already confirmed dead and still missing, you know that a lot of those people up there, especially in rural areas, they had pets and those pets are going to never be reunited because the people aren't there, or they're in situations where they can't keep them anymore because they've lost everything. And relatives or friends may not be able to step up because they're in the same situation. So we are going to see situations where even people can find their pets are going to have to find at least temporary homes and foster homes for those pets while they try to put their lives together.
That does say a lot about the adoption effort that's going to have to be ongoing. Let's say something about the care of animals and their burns. The most extreme and highly publicized cases were, again, the UC Davis use of tilapia skin on the bear's paws.
Wasn't that amazing?
From the Santa Rosa fire last year. But just those ordinary burns on the pads of cats and dogs, it seems that that's a recoverable injury.
Yes, I think the more severe ones we really don't know, the long-term effects are the ones you can't see. The livestock in particular did not come in. They were out through all that, the worst of the air quality. My own horses and goats and chickens were out. I lost a hen. She was an older hen. Where the air quality was a contributing factor or the reason, you know, we'll never know. But the particulate these animals have inhaled, we just don't know the long-term damage that's been done. And the veterinarians are saying to make sure that these outdoor animals don't go back to work right away if they've, you know, they're riding horses, just give them a lot of time to just recover, keep them hydrated. And if you see any situations like coughing or being very quiet, then make sure that your vet checks out. Otherwise, they just need the rest and then time, the tincture of time.
What kind of science is there on animals and the exposure to wildfire smoke? It's a new and growing field in terms of humans, so it must be even in more infancy, I would guess, for animals.
The very interesting thing about all research into animal and human health, it's called something called One Health, is veterinarians and physicians working together because we're all mammals. I mean, basically, we're all mammals. And so you see a lot of things start in animals that are of use to humans and vice versa, that this is also something that's new in veterinary medicine, this One Health movement of realizing we all have to work together to share the data because many of these situations are going to be similar. You see this especially in cancer research, where sometimes things that work in humans are used for animals, mm-hmm. and sometimes research that's being done in a clinical setting, you know, your own pet might go to be part of a trial that will help animals and people. So there's a lot of crossover in this research, and a lot of it will be applicable for both. But of course, with a lot of these animals, since they couldn't come in like people could, they had a much higher rate of exposure that's probably on par with the people up there, with the first responders. And these are all things that are going to need to be watched.
You're listening to pet expert Gina Spadafori. We're talking about animals in the campfire and in general wildfire disaster zones. Do you have a story that's been sticking in your mind that you've been repeating?
The one that sticks to mind, it was fairly early in the fire. I don't know if you remember the lady and her horse who rode out.
Oh.
And then she had to leave, and she left the horse. She had to leave the horse with first responders there. And the horse was just an amazing picture of this beautiful horse who had taken her out, saved this woman's life. And then all the smoke and the darkness all around this beautiful horse and the first responders. And then a couple of days later, she was reunited at a stable. Now, she's still not, I believe she lost her home. She and her horse can't return to it. But they both made it out, and they were reunited. And I think possibly as a horse lover, you know, that really struck with me because a lot of times the best you can do for livestock is turn them loose and hope that they can be found again.
If you think at all about the land, it's not much of a step to understand how much wildlife, how many birds, how many lizards, how many all kinds of animals in between in that spectrum of living creatures that call a forest home would have been lost in this fire.
It's unimaginable, and the biologists will be working with that for many years, not only seeing what's been lost, but how it changes and how it recovers. But yeah, thousands, hundreds of thousands of animals, I'm sure.
So there are relief efforts dedicated to animals. Our CAP Radio reporter Julia Mitrich was in the area yesterday and reports that the Butte County Farm Bureau and the Butte Ag Foundation have an assistance fund that is for animals related to the campfire. Again, monetary donations so that things like food and housing and other maintenance can be paid for is really the best route for donating.
Yes.
And the group that you mentioned, NVADG, same thing, cash donations.
Cash donations.
So we will post a link, and there is a website to donate to, and they have a Chico address. Are they based in Chico?
I believe so. They've also put out, if you can like their page on Facebook, they've also put out a couple of notices for physical help in unloading semis with food and hay and whatnot. So follow their page and see. They'll let you know the ways to help them at whatever particular time.
Sorry if this is a curveball, but the Red Cross, in its emergency relief, does it cover pet care now?
I believe the Red Cross has some shelters, and that's been one of the big changes. They never did, but I believe that they do now have shelters, not all of them, but some shelters that do accept pets because of the much greater awareness. But I'm not sure if they're up in Butte County. I think it's been just a massive volunteer. And I think that's, you know, we've talked about that before with disasters, that in the age of the internet, the ability to hook up money and volunteers really does help to get a massive army, almost too much sometimes, as you say, because sometimes they can bring the wrong thing or be in the way. But these groups can let people know what's necessary and let people who need the help know where to go, where to find their animals. And it's just it's one of the bright spots, I think, to see how people help each other for helping other people and also helping the animals, because we know how important those animals are to those people.
I'm thinking a lot about tomorrow, about how Thanksgiving will be in the fire zone. I do want to, since you're here, talk about pets and Thanksgiving, what animals can and can't eat and how to keep them safe.
The biggest thing that will happen at Thanksgiving is people will give fatty foods to pets who aren't used to it, and you'll end up at the ER with pancreatitis, which can be lethal, but can also just be really miserable and awfully expensive as an emergency. The other thing is you often have people who are not used to being around pets, so especially your older people. You might have a great aunt who's a little unsteady on her feet, and you don't want your big, goofy Labrador to jump up, so make sure that you're protecting the people as well as the pets. Things like the biggest thing that I actually got caught on, I was visiting friends and I left some medication in a carry-on bag, which I knew better, and it was unzipped, and I came down a hall to find a nose in the bag. Nothing happened, but I was like, oh my gosh, Gina, you know so much better than that. So make sure if visitors put their medications in drawers or, you know, behind cupboard doors or whatever, nuts, raisins, any kind of treats, get those off the county coffee tables, because your pets will just come by and snarf them up. So those sorts of things. Alcohol, not funny. I mean, a lot of people. Marijuana, you're seeing a lot of animals that will eat the edibles. So make sure that anything that you know, your common sense will tell you, make sure those things are out of reach. And don't give anything, you know, a little bit of white meat turkey is fine, but stay away from the fatty foods for the dogs and cats.
All right. Well, once again, I'm wishing you a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
And you have a perfect
puppy.
You
didn't answer my side dish.
You know, I was thinking about this as we were talking, because every year I do ask you your side
ravioli
dish. Yes, always the favorite. She brings the Italian to the
Spotify
Thanksgiving.
Spotify always have ravioli for Thanksgiving.
Dinner table. Bowie is a perfect pup,
He's
too.
A very
He'll
nice
puppy. He'll
be good
over the holiday. Thanks a lot, Gina.
Thank you. And have a nice Thanksgiving.
To everyone still working on this time that we're in with the fires. Mm. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. The first of two winter storms is going to bring rain and snow throughout the day today. A stronger storm moves in Thanksgiving night. And by the time both storms have moved through, if you heard this program yesterday, the National Weather Service was forecasting 14 to 20 inches of snow blanketing the upper elevations of the Sierra. What a weekend that might be at ski areas. So we're going to check in with a few of them. On the phone right now is Kevin Cooper. He's Senior Communications Manager for Heavenly Mountain Resort and Kirkwood Mountain Resort. So they each have their separate microclimates. But Coop, how are you? Happy start to the winter.
Thank you very much, Beth. Yeah, it's a great start to the winter. I mean, it's been dry. Looks like this is the first big storm that we've had in 277 days. So this is a really good welcome to the winter. And definitely we're excited here on Tahoe South, up at Kirkwood Mountain and all around the region just to see the moisture start pulling, you know, and one, for the ski resorts, but most importantly, for those that are affected down in Butte County and in Paradise, that water is going to help the firefighters from the Oregon border all the way down to Southern California. So great start, and we're feeling it up here.
What are you expecting for snowfall at each of the different areas?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, I was reading the National Weather Service this morning pretty intensely. And what's interesting is this has tapped into a deeper moisture band and it's starting to slow down. So forecast models at lake level at 6,200 feet, we're looking at probably 2 to 4 inches between Wednesday and Thursday. Now along the western crest down towards Kirkwood, that's where it's going to get a little interesting. And even down towards 395 towards Mammoth, anywhere between 8 and 24 inches. It just depends on how that storm picks up. And with the winds that will be associated with it, that orographic lift, you should be seeing significant snowfall over State Route 88, the Carson Pass and the Carson Spur towards Kirkwood and down towards Mammoth. As the system slips from the north, moving towards the south, over on the Truckee side or up on Donner Pass, Sugar Bowl, Boreal, North Star, Squaw Alpine, they're going to be seeing anywhere between 8 and 16 inches, depending on the elevation. So just a really good start. And, you know, Beth, the most important part is this is a warm storm, and that's what we need. Mm. We need that water to get into the ground. So when snow does start to fall and the temperatures start to drop, it bonds. It gives a really nice bond layer. So we don't have more like a Colorado snowpack. And we really start off with a really good Sierra snowpack.
Mm. So tell me what's open this weekend. It looks like slopes at Heavenly are open for sure.
Yeah, so all around the lake, multiple resorts are open. Mount Rose opened up early in October with man-made snow, so they were the first to get out of the gate. They've been making snow, so Mount Rose is open. Boreal is open. North Star is open. Heavenly is open. Squaw and Alpine are open as well. Kirkwood opening up towards the weekend, and Sierra Tahoe looking at the 26th to open up. It depends on how much snow that we get through this next storm for them to open up more terrain. All the resorts are on limited terrain right now where they have their snowmaking systems. The biggest snowmaking systems in the Sierras are at Alpine and Squaw Valley and at North Star and Heavenly. They have the most terrain opened up. And then the smaller resorts have other little areas opened up, but it's still just enough to kind of, I like to call it wet your beak. Just get your feet underneath you again. I already have 4 days underneath my feet, so just a good way to kind of come up. By
wow.
The weekend, though, more terrain should open.
Yeah, and if this storm does move through and the skies are clear and the air quality up there is good, it could be a remarkable maybe Saturday afternoon and Sunday of skiing.
Yeah, it should be, too. The air quality has been good. We did get a little bit of haze over the last few days, but the wind should be able to push that out. And then Saturday, Sunday, into Monday should be great. And then just looking at some of the forecast models out there, there is another system out there pretty much like Tuesday into Wednesday. So hopefully the storm doors open and California will start seeing that most needed precipitation. It'll help the firefighters and it'll also help us up here in Tahoe get the ski season fired up for the Christmas holiday.
All right. I have to check myself and you. We both said skiing a few times. I don't want to miss those snowboarders. we'll
yes,
add them into.
Right,
there's
right.
Such a big population now at the resorts.
Yeah, for sure. If you're sliding, it's all good. It's all about sliding and having a good time and enjoying the great outdoors.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving, Coop. So glad to kick off the snow season with you today.
Well, thank you very much, Beth. Everybody have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll see you out on the mountain.
All right. That was Kevin Cooper, Senior Communications Manager for Heavenly and Kirkwood. He mentioned that Mount Rose was the first out of the gate, and we do have Mike Pierce on the phone, Director of Marketing for Mount Rose. So happy snow season to you too, Mike.
Thanks, Beth. You too.
For some people who might not know, describe the location of Mount Rose. And again, I'm going to talk about microclimates because you could be looking at a slightly different snowfall this weekend.
Yeah, Mount Rose sits on the north shore of Lake Tahoe, essentially between Reno and Incline Village. So we start at 8,260 feet, so we have the highest base elevation, which does bode well for us, especially when we get these storms that can come in warmer. So we anticipate getting all snow during this during these systems that are coming through Saturday. So we're very optimistic that we could get anywhere up to 20 inches.
Yeah, when that forecast came through yesterday, I have to admit that I was surprised. But with your location that high, you'd get some of the most of the snowfall this weekend, wouldn't you?
It's definitely to our advantage. When it comes in warm at different points, we almost always get snow out of it. Last year was a key example. We had a huge storm in November that produced 40 inches of snow at 8,000 feet. So that meant at our base elevation, we had started with a huge snowpack. So that was very advantageous to us. So sometimes altitude is definitely your friend. But in general, just Tahoe, getting a good blanket is exactly what we want this time of year. Get us started in a big way.
You opened early. How many people have been making the trip to the slopes already? And how much is open this weekend for you?
We got open to the top yesterday, so we did provide the full ski experience starting yesterday with our Northwest Magnum 6 going up to all the way to the summit at 9,700 feet. So that gave pretty much a big 1,440 vertical feet of the true ski and snowboarding experience, which a lot of people are hunting for. So we got that open yesterday. Before that, we had a lot of beginner terrain open with some terrain park features as well. So we've had some limited offerings, but getting open on the 19th of October, I mean, that's our goal. If we can, we will. And with our extensive snowmaking and altitude, that's always our goal, is everybody that's got that itch to get on the snow early, we're there to scratch it.
All right. I like just talking about snow. It makes me happy. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mike. Glad to have you on the program, and happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone up there enjoying this weekend.
You too. Thanks for the call.
That is Mike Pierce, Director of Marketing at Mount Rose. So none of us really have the meteorology credentials, but Craig Schumacher does from the National Weather Service, and he's on the phone now. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
I don't know how much of that you just heard, but snow resort leaders are quite expert at predicting the snow. I want to hear it from you. What's the storm system, I guess the 1-2 punch of it, look like now?
Yeah, the first wave we have coming in this afternoon, things should really get going over the Sierra after 1 o'clock. The snow levels are going to start off a little bit on the high side. They're going to be maybe starting off around 7,000 feet, but we'll see those gradually lowering down around 6,000 feet overnight tonight. Then they'll lower down even further, 5,500 feet, as we head into Thursday and Thursday night. And that's when we expect the heaviest snow, actually, Thursday and Thursday night. So it's kind of a double shot. We'll get, first wave of snow late this afternoon and tonight, and then a little bit heavier burst again on Thursday and Friday. And generally, areas above 6,000 feet are going to see a foot or better of snow.
So that seems a little bit scaled back from yesterday, and that maybe even the rain totals are scaled back a little bit from earlier in the week. Is that accurate?
Well, I think maybe with the first wave, they're a little bit lighter, sort of the system that we have coming in late this afternoon and tonight. But actually, there are some indications that the storm that we have been coming in Thursday and Friday might be a little bit on the wetter side than what we were earlier forecasting. The snow levels do rise a little bit Friday, late Friday and Friday night. So that is sort of maybe why the snow amounts are a little bit lighter now, as we're expecting a little bit higher snow levels as we get into Friday.
All right. And the most dangerous travel time up over the Sierra sounds like it will be Thursday night overnight.
That is right. Yes, that is correct. That's when we'll have the lowest snow levels with the heaviest precipitation.
Okay, Craig, happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. And thanks again to everybody over there at the NWS office. We always appreciate your help.
Oh, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Craig. That is Craig Schumacher from the National Weather Service. We're going to keep going. Up next is the Run to Feed the Hungry, and you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. If you were here, you would know I have a turkey on my head right now. 25 years ago, Father Dan Madigan believed that, yes, people would gather on Thanksgiving morning to help support the Sacramento Food Bank, which he had founded years earlier. It was Gaylord Walker that came to him with the idea. And he was right. Almost 800 people did that first run. I know, I was there. But thousands and thousands are registered for the 25th anniversary event tomorrow. And in the studio with me is Kelly Siefkin, who has become iconic as a face and voice for the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services and this event. What a tradition.
It is so incredible. I can't believe we're celebrating 25 years tomorrow.
What's the expectation for tomorrow? We may have rain in the forecast. We've had all this smoke air, and yet it's a huge anniversary.
I'm expecting a lot of excitement and energy around it. I think the people who turn out for Run to Feed the Hungry come no matter what because they love doing the event. It is a Sacramento tradition, and people have guests from out of town that they bring and family that come only once a year, and they bring them to Run to Feed the Hungry.
What about this turkey I have on my head?
You look amazing. I hope everybody dresses as beautifully as you tomorrow. It's really fun. People have really stepped up their game in terms of making it a fun and festive event on Thanksgiving morning. So for the 25th, we brought out lots of merchandise, including that amazing gobbler, those gloves to keep you warm, the tie-dye shirt. It was something that people really wanted, and we were happy to deliver.
So crossing over the 30,000 mark this year?
Fingers crossed. The smoke has been definitely a challenge for getting people to register in advance, which is most commonly what people do for Run to Feed the Hungry. But about 30 minutes ago, it started sprinkling, and it's going to rain all day to clean out that smoke. And we're supposed to get a tiny break tomorrow morning for Thanksgiving.
Was there a point that the run staff considered perhaps canceling?
We were definitely paying attention, and the community was very concerned, but we wanted to wait and see what was going to happen. The event goes on rain or shine, and this would be our first or smoke opportunity, but unfortunately, the event is so large, we can't just reschedule it for another day. So we knew that people would have to make a choice, but the great news is so many supporters understand that Run to Feed the Hungry supports Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. We don't get a percentage. We own and operate the event, so they knew their registration was going to a good cause. So if they couldn't come out, they'd still be wearing their shirts with pride at home on their sofa on Thanksgiving Day.
This is an important clarification that the registration, for the most part, for most people, will be done in advance, as well as the merchandise purchase. So whether people show up tomorrow morning or not, the donations have happened.
Absolutely. And that's what we're so grateful for. And if anybody has been on the fence because of the weather, whether the rain or the smoke would deter, I encourage folks to still sign up at runtofeedthehungry.com or swing by Fremont Presbyterian to register in person. You have till 7 o'clock tonight. Be a drumstick dasher. It's a virtual participation. You still get the bib, you still get the shirt, but if you're out of town or have to cook the big meal, you still can help feed families in our community.
So you said Fremont Presbyterian. That's a big difference this year. I have to say, from my own experience, it's been wonderful to be able to be there for the advance pickup of the number, the merchandise, and everything. But it is important to say, for all the people who park at Sac State and might be accustomed to walking up to the tents, registering that morning, and then walking to the start line, that is changing this year.
Big change, but yeah, a really positive one. We're so thankful for Fremont Presbyterian Church because it's a much bigger space. You're all in one area. You don't have to go outside. But if you do park at Sac State anticipating picking up your shirt or still want to register on Thanksgiving morning, follow the direction of the volunteers who are going to create a human chain between Sac State and Fremont Presbyterian to make sure you get safely. But you have a good tip earlier. Come a few minutes before you normally do to make that additional step to and from the start line.
Fremont Presbyterian Church sits across the street from that parking lot at the Scottish Rite Temple, just to give you a locator.
And if you've been to the run before, it's right past the finish line. It's at 5770 Carlson, which is right at Carlson and H Street.
Also, let's talk about the staggered start times, because 10K runners will begin at 8:15. The rest of the field begins at 9, the 5K and the walkers. So talk to me about the flow of people.
The great news about that is you don't have to decide the distance until you wake up on Thanksgiving morning. You don't have to, I haven't been training, I'm not sure if I'm ready. Just choose when you wake up on Thanksgiving morning. My tip is, if you want to do the 10K, to be on time. Don't be late. If you get mixed in with the 5K, the 10K will be closed. So you have to make sure you're there on time. I would say about 20% of the people do the 10K every year. So they come, they're prepared, they're ready. They're going to give it their all. The horn goes off, everybody starts, and then the massive population arrives for the 5K, because the majority of the folks are going to stroll to feed the hungry on Thanksgiving morning. They've got their strollers, they've got their coffee mugs, and they're out to enjoy Thanksgiving with their family. So regardless of your athletic ability, we encourage you to come out and participate.
You are listening to Kelly Siefkin from Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. We are talking about this 25th anniversary of the Run to Feed the Hungry. If you're a David Lobenberg art fan, David did create a beautiful watercolor poster for this year's run.
It's so exciting that he generated and generously donated this gorgeous piece. We've turned it into a commemorative poster, and you can purchase it for only $15. So that's available when you go and pick up your packet at Fremont Presbyterian Church.
So let's go back to the very beginning, because my daughter was one in a stroller, and my son, and now this is going to tell you a little bit about how the run used to be, did the run on rollerblades.
I can't even imagine.
He was 6 years old, and there were many, many people with either rollerblades, dogs, whatever. It was a very quaint and sweet community event. Over time, the rules have had to change. And when you have 30,000 people, you can't have rollerblades anymore.
I'd like to think that it's still sweet, and I'd like to think it's still a community event, but it absolutely has grown magnificently in size. For a couple of safety things, we do encourage people to leave their pets at home. And unfortunately, that is because many people have brought their dogs. The dogs are terrified by the crowds, and they get loose. And then it's really unfun for everybody. So we encourage folks to leave their pets at home that day. Strollers are absolutely welcome. Rollerblades, probably will leave those at home too, just for getting around safely. But if you can't come out to the run, register virtually and then stay at home and cheer on folks from your porch or from TV that morning.
Can you talk about the huge fundraising day that this is for Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services? And if people don't know that there are 16 maybe plus programs now that are serviced by this, but it was quite a number of years ago that this became a $1 million day.
Absolutely.
For SFBFS, and now it's beyond that.
Absolutely. We actually net about $950,000 from Run to Feed the Hungry. It's nearly a fifth of our budget, which is tremendous, and that helps keep those 14 programs and services going year-round. So everybody who crosses that start line or from their virtual participation is helping make sure that we're getting food to people, providing education. All of our services are available at no cost, and that's through donor participation, whether in special events or through financial contributions, or people are maybe unaware that we are not a government-funded organization but a private nonprofit organization. So that allows us to ebb and flow and change the programming to make sure that we're best meeting the needs of members in our community. And as the needs grow, we shift and change, and that's made possible by things like Run to Feed the Hungry.
That said, you have been an important voice in the community discussion and the confronting of housing issues, people experiencing homeless, the poverty-related needs of the community. And so I ask your take on what the year ahead looks like and whether we're making progress in solving some of these problems.
I'll start with great news. Yes, we're making progress. Feeding America puts out a food insecurity report every single year, and that has gone down the last 3 years. In Sacramento County, there's now under 240,000 individuals, and I know that's a lot, but we're making progress. We're currently reaching about 157,000 of those people every single month, so the gap is shrinking and we are making progress. And as that Feeding America number goes down, that's meaning more people are getting jobs, more people are prepared to reenter the workforce, more people have housing that they can afford, etc. So we are making great strides. As far as predicting the future, we will see what that holds. We are going to continue to really work on how we distribute food. We change it constantly. We work together with the neighborhood food access networks, which are these 220 partner agencies that we work with, to make it much more efficient. The majority of our partner agencies are volunteer run, which means volunteers are getting in their own car, driving their own gas on their own time to come and pick up food that they can distribute at their local church pantry or school or community center. So we're doing things like banding them together to making sure we have correct times and we're covering all of the days of the week so people who are in need can come, and then taking them food. So we're really trying to modify how food distribution is occurring. We're going to continue to do that as we get feedback from the community.
Hmm. Well, congratulations on all these years of the run.
Thank you.
What color shirt will volunteers be in tomorrow?
A beautiful blue shirt. Look for the blue shirts on Thanksgiving morning. And again, if you haven't registered, please consider just being a drumstick dasher and register today.
Cap Radio has a team out there.
Yay!
Sac State, I know, has many
Yay!
Teams. That we have enough family members going, we should have been a team, but we'll. That's okay. We're all out there. And I think the great thing about it is starting the day in a way that you know is helping other people in your community.
So. And you get to go home and eat two pieces of pie.
Or three. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you, Beth.
Kelly Siefkin with Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. We will post a link so that you could jump on and register for the Run to Feed the Hungry right now. How about that? And in the meantime, enjoy all the preparations for Thanksgiving safely. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. By the way, Bert Johnson is now officially full-time with us, so that's a great blessing for him. Glad to have you on board, Bert. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. The Insight team will be off for the holiday. We're back with live shows on Monday. Make it a safe and peaceful and very happy Thanksgiving.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.